Canada. Rock and roll.
Hi, it's Innes. You're listening to CFRC Radio in Kingston, Canada.
Hello, this is Jamie from Shushu. You are listening to CFRC 101 point what?
Nine.
And CFRC what?
.ca.
.ca.
Monday. When traffic's a nightmare. When the workplace is hectic. When your boss calls you in for a meeting. When nature isn't on your side. There's only one thing you can do.
But no need to wake up the neighbors. Tune in every Monday night from 11 p.m. to midnight for Shed Progressions, where we play an hour of cool jazz to help you relax after a long day. Again, that's Shed Progressions every Monday night at 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. We're not afraid to get a little funky.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, Rebuilding Gaza.
We have limited options and we have limited resources, but still, we won't give up. We will try our best. We already tried for 15 months and we will keep our attempts to alleviate the suffering of people, but also we are calling for help.
We speak with Asim al-Nabi of Gaza City Municipality about rebuilding Gaza. He also tells us about his search for Rifat al-Arir's grave.
I'm not sure if the people would be able to listen to the details. Carrying your friend, like the bones of your friend. There is thousands of people still under the rubble. So Rifat's story is not a unique story.
And the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima shares his take on Trump's recent suggestion to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
What Trump was stating in starkly crude terms is the essential logic of Zionism, past, present, and future.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and discussions from our live stream broadcast on February 6th, 2025. Later in the show, we'll be speaking with Asim al-Nabi from Gaza City Municipality about why Palestinians don't care what Trump says. They're staying in Gaza. But first, listen to this Palestinian man's response to Trump's absurd claims of forcefully transferring Palestinians from Gaza. Let me translate. He said, they're saying that Trump wants to forcibly displace Gaza's people. Gaza's people are here digging a well, and they're rebuilding Gaza from scratch. I swear you have your work cut out for you with Gazawis, and you're in for a long ride. You're in for a long ride. The Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abunima, brings us his analysis of Trump's comments.
By now, everyone has heard about U.S. President Donald Trump's dangerous fantasy of ethnically cleansing the Gaza Strip of its entire population, some 2 million Palestinians, forcing them to go to Jordan and Egypt, and then turning Gaza into a luxury playground for the rich. Let's take a look at a couple of clips of the president's comment.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area. Do a real job. Do something different. Just can't go back. If you go back, it's going to end up the same way it has for 100 years.
Would Palestinians have the right to return to Gaza if they left while the rebuilding was happening?
It would be my hope that we could do something really nice, really good, where they wouldn't want to return. Why would they want to return? The place has been hell. It's been one of the meanest, toughest places on earth. And right now, it's I've seen every picture from every angle, better than if I were there. And nobody can live there. You can't live there. So if we can build them through massive amounts of money supplied by other people.
So Israeli leaders, including Benjamin Netanyahu, grinning next to President Trump, have reacted with glee. That includes so-called opposition leader Benny Gantz and far-right politician Itamar Ben-Gvir, who said he would return to Netanyahu's coalition government only when he saw Palestinians starting to leave Gaza. But within hours of those comments at the White House on Tuesday, Trump administration officials were walking the president's comments back amid a huge international uproar. Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia flatly rejected Trump's comments. Saudi Arabia said its insistence on a Palestinian state before any normalization of relations with Israel was, quote, non-negotiable. It quickly emerged that the idea seems to have come from Trump without any previous planning within the U.S. government or even coordination with Israel, notwithstanding the sheer illegality and depraved immorality of ethnic cleansing. It was clear that no thought had gone into how the United States would occupy and own Gaza, as Trump put it, or how it would defeat and remove the Palestinian resistance that had humiliated the Israeli army for 15 months and forced it to retreat. And who would finance the massive reconstruction? Trump made clear it would not be the United States. Was the president seriously proposing to send the U.S. military to Gaza, the same U.S. military that was incapable of building a floating pier off Gaza's coast after spending $230 million on it? You may remember this story from back in July. Trump confirmed that he wasn't proposing to send any U.S. troops to occupy Gaza, claiming in a post on his Truth Social website that, quote, the Gaza Strip would be turned over to the United States by Israel at the conclusion of fighting and that no soldiers by the U.S. would be needed. But even if the plan appeared to fall apart almost immediately, it has set off alarms and exacerbated fears that the ethnic cleansing of Gaza is Israel's ultimate goal. After all, Israel only exists due to the mass ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their homeland in 1948 and ever since. The fulfillment of the Zionist project is predicated on the expulsion of the Palestinian people from their land. As long as Zionism exists, Palestinians can never be safe. That is just as true in the West Bank, where many Israelis are undoubtedly optimistic that Trump will bless Israel's formal annexation of the illegally occupied territory, something that Trump has also hinted at in recent days by pointing out how small Israel is on the map. So what Trump was stating in starkly crude terms is the essential logic of Zionism, past, present, and future, a logic that is overwhelmingly supported by the Israeli Jewish public. And the idea that Trump spouted specifically with respect to Gaza is not new. Almost a year ago, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who served as the architect of the so-called Abraham Accords in the first Trump administration, spun a similar fantasy. Gaza's waterfront property could be very valuable, Kushner said in an interview as the genocide in Gaza accelerated. Kushner added, it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there, but from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. That sounds very similar to what Trump said in his press conference with Netanyahu on Tuesday. Well, you won't be surprised to learn that it is being reported that Kushner played a key role in crafting Trump's comments. And you may remember back in October 2023, in the first days of the genocide, there was a leaked document from Israel's intelligence ministry setting out a plan to force the population of Gaza into Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. At the time, Netanyahu's office downplayed the plan as merely an initial document of the kind that can be found in dozens of iterations at all levels of government. It claimed that the document had not been discussed at any official forum in Israel. But in May of 2024, Netanyahu's office issued a PowerPoint presentation for its so-called Gaza 2035 plan, where Gaza would supposedly be turned into a high-tech free trade zone ruled by Arab collaborators under Israeli control and all financed by Gulf money. According to the Jerusalem Post, Netanyahu's plan also says that if such an intervention is successful in Gaza, it can be repeated in Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon. And of course, there was the so-called General's Plan, an unofficial scheme Israel apparently attempted to implement to completely and permanently depopulate northern Gaza. Although various Israeli politicians and generals openly fantasize about expelling the population of Gaza, Israel's government has never explicitly said that is the ultimate goal, even if Netanyahu and those close to him yearn for that outcome. It is clear that Israel has acted as if that's the goal. Its deliberate mass murder by bombing and mass destruction of Gaza's housing and infrastructure, healthcare system, its deliberate blocking of food and humanitarian aid to starve the population, all this can only have had one intention, to make Gaza uninhabitable and force its population to seek sustainable life somewhere else. And of course, all that was done with the full knowledge and unconditional assistance of the United States under the administration of President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Indeed, Israel could not have done it without the Democratic Party administration's full support. The reality, however, is that after more than 15 months of genocide and indiscriminate destruction, the Palestinian people did not leave Gaza. And we just saw how hundreds of thousands of Palestinians returned home to the north as soon as the coastal road was opened as part of the ongoing ceasefire and prisoner exchange deal.
That was the Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abu Nima. Later on in the program, Asim al-Nabi tells us the harrowing tale of finding the remains of our beloved friend Rifat al-Arir in Gaza. But first, he joins me and Ali to discuss the building of Gaza and his reaction to Donald Trump's plan for Gaza.
Joining us now is someone who is intimately familiar with the realities in Gaza. He is an engineer and PhD researcher, and he serves as the spokesperson for the Gaza City municipality. He is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada. I'm really pleased and honored to welcome Asim al-Nabi. Welcome, Asim.
Thank you for having me today. Respect and love from Gaza and to all Electronic Intifada team. It's my pleasure, actually, and my honor to be with you today to talk about our beloved city, Gaza.
Thank you so much,
Asim. It's our honor.
And of course, we're going to talk about the situation in Gaza City. But what's your reaction to Donald Trump's comments that everyone has heard? And what's the reaction of people around you?
People here, they don't care, you know, like they are busy in finding water, struggling with their daily, you know, daily tasks. I think Mr. President Trump knows, as I know, as you know, as everyone knows, that there is only one solution to this complex situation. Just give us our state, just give us our rights, give us our self-determination. It is very easy. Why they should take that headache, like moving 2.3 million? And we have our own land. We have our own capabilities. We are smart people. We would like to participate in the international development. We have doctors, engineers, teachers, artists. I mean, there is only one solution. Even our grandparents understood that solution. And actually, that idea started 15 months ago to force people to leave Gaza, and the harsh way doesn't work. If Mr. President Trump wants really to solve this issue, he can do it easily. Just give the Palestinians their rights. That's easy. That's what I can think about. It. Moving people and relocating them is not that easy. There's easier ways. Why should you pay all of that, billions of the Americans' money, to relocate people, to do another. I don't understand that. We want to live in peace. We want to contribute to the development of the world. We want to do something. He could try, you know. He could try, but a lot of people tried that way in the last 70 years or 80 years. We are here since 4,000 years. A lot of people came and tried to kick us out of this land, but they left. It's our land, you know, it's our land. We are good people. We are smart people. We deserve better than that. We want to live here. I want to live in a Sharia, you know. You hear some people who moved from forcibly displaced from the north to the south. They felt that they are out of their land. It's only 15 kilometers between the north and the south. And even in Gaza City itself, some people from Ashujaiya, if they left Ashujaiya, said, no, we want to come back to Ashujaiya. They can't live without being in Ashujaiya or At-Tufah or Tal el-Hawa or their neighborhoods.
Asim, I wanted to ask you, actually, when we were all watching the flood of people coming through the what used to be the Netzarim corridor and coming back up to the north after being displaced from the south, like you were just saying, and we watched you live on Al Jazeera Arabic and other networks as well, talking about what it was like being there. You were, you know, sitting in a chair, speaking with reporters, and this like flood of people is just, you know, happening behind you. Can you talk about what it was like on that day, January 20-something, when everyone was coming back to the north?
I called it a day of hugs and tears. My sister, I have a smart sister called Nisma. She is 17 years old. She was born in 2008. She survived 5 wars. So she called that night and she said, I want to go. And I said, no, where to go? And she said, I want to see people going back to Gaza. Then I told her it will be like, you know, crowded area, a lot of people are coming back, and you are a young girl. They said, no, please, Asim. Then at 6 a.m., we are waiting for people to enter Gaza City. And I neglected everything, but I just focused on the hugs and tears. People were like, you know, like a thirsty man, so water after a very long time. So like families gathered again, couples gathered again, kids with their parents and or their father. So it is a day of hugs and tears. And I was very happy. I knew that the war is after the war. Like now, there's like a common sentence now in Gaza that the war after the war, because there is a massive destruction, there's no water, the infrastructure damaged, but the people just forgot everything on that day, and they just like, even strangers. I hugged a lot of strangers that day, you know, like, because I felt that we are all one family. Like, if I saw like an old man with nobody, I used to hug him to tell him that, oh, you are welcome, father, please, you are welcome here, give him some water, talk about his way, you know, like, because it was like 10 kilometers from the south to the north. And also, this happiness, there's something behind this happiness, like the struggling, the suffering, the pain of those people who came back to their city after the Israeli forcibly displaced them to another area. They called it humanitarian zone. I was like glad to see my people come back to their city, to this nice city. And I asked people, how do you feel, father? He said, look, my soul came back to me. He felt exactly like a dying man. And his soul returned back to him after he just entered Gaza. And if you see Gaza on that time, it's like, you know, a destroyed buildings, a damaged roads, sewage leakage, you know. So it's like, you need to put yourself in the Gaza shoe to understand what is Gaza City meant to them. It's not only the buildings, it's not only the roads, it's not only the ancient places. It's the smell of Gaza City. It's the feelings there. And that's it. It's something complicated. We can't really explain people why we love Gaza to the max.
Tell us about what the municipality has been able to do, what the most immediate challenges are for people in Gaza, and give us a sense of how people can survive there amid so much destruction.
There is a massive destruction. It's not only a destruction in the infrastructure. There is a destruction actually in the civic facilities, not only in houses and buildings. We are talking about a destruction in hospitals, schools, universities, roads, public parks, cultural centers, libraries, water wells, sewage pumps. It's unbelievable destruction, actually. And as an engineer and a researcher in engineering, I can tell you there is a lot to do to rebuild Gaza. For example, let us talk about water now. Water can reach now to only 40% of the total area in Gaza City, while 60% of the total area has no water for a month now. And people need to carry water for a long distance. And they got limited amount of water. The international standard, for example, stated that each person should get like 120 liters daily, including drinking water, showering, cooking, and all of their personal needs. While people in Gaza right now got less than 15 liters daily for drinking, for showering, for cooking, for everything. So there's a massive destruction in the water facilities. 75% of the central water wells in Gaza City have been destroyed. There is a destruction in more than 100,000 of the water networks in Gaza City itself, while maybe double or triple that damages in around the Gaza Strip. People are really struggling to survive. Their daily routine started in the early morning, looking for water, charging their devices, find like some wood to cook for their kids, do their work, like a lot of freelancers and, you know, some engineers or even artists who like all the type of people, they are looking for electricity and internet connection to do their job. So every single corner of that suffering has another layers of suffering. We can't just say there is a water scarcity. Being deep in that crisis will show you like a painful details. Like my nephew Albara, he lost his father, a respected postgraduate man in Gaza, Mohtaz Rajab, 37 years old. He lost his cousins, my nephews, Rasha and Ahmed, 10 and 11 years old. Al-Bara can't process the absences of his father while he is very busy finding water. On that day, he told me, uncle, come to visit us on Tuesday. Then I said, why Tuesday? Why not Monday? Why not Thursday? And he said, because I am not carrying water on that day. Then he explained that me and my cousin agreed to, I help him on Monday to carry water for our family and his family. Then I will take Tuesday off. Then my cousin will carry the water and move the water on Tuesday. And Albara is 11 years old. He is carrying 100 liters, which is like 100 kilogram daily. 1 kilometer, then he carry it for another 4 floors on his own and the small hands. So when we say there's a water scarcity, there is a lot of suffering behind that word. And when we talk, for example, the accumulated rubbish and waste in Gaza, there is 100,000 tons of rubbish, of waste now accumulated in the city. So it's like only one sentence, but if you go deep, you will understand this is means diseases, skin conditions, especially among the children. So it's unimaginable suffering. And this is not only during the war. It become more difficult even after the ceasefire, because a lot of our citizens came back to Gaza now and to the North Gaza. So the needs to the water, needs for the civic services, the municipal services. Now, they need more of that. And we still have the same limited resources. We tried our best. We are trying our best. We listed, we put a very nice plan to open all the roads, to maintain the water wells, the water networks. And we delivered that plan, that needs list, the challenges, everything in two languages, in English and Arabic. And we sent it before the ceasefire to the international associations, to the NGOs. And we discussed with them the details about the technical and all the details. And they promised that, oh no, we will help you, don't worry. So, for example, we lost 85% of our total heavy vehicles. So when we talk about heavy vehicles, people might think, oh, it's okay. But it's not, because the heavy vehicles are moving and collecting and moving and transferring the waste. Heavy vehicles are doing the maintenance for damaged networks. We use it to open the closure roads. So it's essential. We just need the heavy vehicles to do our basic job, cleaning the streets, maintain the and repair the water networks. So we are not talking about the reconstruction plan, which we really hope to start to do it as soon as possible, helping people find, like, you know, a way to rebuild their home, their houses. But till now, we are, I think, more than 2 weeks of ceasefire, but we still wait for that heavy vehicles. And a lot of other needs, like the maintenance for the equipment for maintenance, the tools for, you know, that we need to use it in water wells, generators, sufficient amount of fuel. There's a lot of things. And we just wait, you know, just wait. And people are still suffering. So time is just fast for the politicians around the world, but it's very, very slow to the people in Gaza.
Awesome. You said that international organizations promised to assist. This is day 19 of the ceasefire. What do you think is the obstacle to this equipment and these essential supplies coming in? Or what are they telling you?
We should wait. They are trying their best. It is a political issue still under the discussion. No real explanation about what is happening in the ground. Like, for example, Sheikh Ridwan Basin, like, and it's a very big pool in Gaza, in the north of Gaza City. We used to collect storm water there, then it used to come to the groundwater. Now it's mixed with sewage and with wastewater. So it's very dangerous, considered as an environmental and healthy crisis in the city now. What we need is special parts for the main pipeline. So we need, like, mainly a very special pipelines, you know? We asked for this pipeline 1 year ago. We published many statements. We talked to the NGOs. We talked to the, actually we talked to everyone about that. Till now, we no answer about that, just promises. And to be honest with you, without these equipments, without these vehicles, without these tools, we won't be able to alleviate the suffering of people. This is the truth. We tried our best, and we are trying our best. But also, we are humans. I am working now since October 7th. No weekend, no day off, no salaries, nothing. So we are very tired. And my colleagues, like a lot of them, engineers, technicians, workers, there's a massive destruction with limited resources. So without that help, without providing us with this essential tools and equipments, we won't be able to alleviate the suffering of people. And when I talk about alleviating the suffering, just giving them the basic services, water, collect the waste, maintain and open the roads. That's it. We are not talking about the huge plans or develop the city, just to provide people with basic services. And I'm sorry to say that, but this is the truth, that we have limited options and we have limited resources. But still, we won't give up. We will try our best. We already tried for 15 months, and we will keep our attempts to alleviate the suffering of people. But also, we are calling for help. The NGOs should do something.
Asim, it may seem difficult from the perspective of today when things are so difficult in Gaza. The basic needs of people are not being met. But tell us how you see the future of Gaza. What do you see in Gaza's future, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, any time frame you want? Because we're hearing visions of Gaza from politicians and Donald Trump that have nothing to do with the Palestinian people and the people of Gaza. I want to hear your vision.
I have to answer based on my academic and research background. While everything happening now in Gaza is based on the politicians' background. But I think there is a chance to remove the rebels in Gaza within short time if we get the needs. So I want just to put some short sentences to make it like as the border of our discussion. Second, we can rebuild Gaza in a few years. Yes or no? Yes, we can do it. Is it difficult? It is very difficult. Do we have the ability to do it? We have the ability. We have the engineers, we have the smart people, we have the workers. We have the heavy vehicles, the drivers, and we have the capabilities to do it within the frame time that we need to do it. The third thing is, do we have the resources to do that? Of course not, because Israel destroyed everything in Gaza. There is an intensive destruction even in the human resources, not only in the infrastructure. So even we lost engineers, we lost professors, we lost a lot of our workers, our technicians, so we have limited resources. So this is the basic questions to understand the situation. We did a plan for the, like, I can't say a plan for the reconstruction, like a general dialogue, you know, about the reconstruction plan. And we discussed about these principles with NGOs, with some professors inside and outside Gaza. And we had like what I can call it, a philosophy about the reconstruction. A very nice one, domestic. But we did it as a Palestinian, you know. We understand our culture. We understand our society. We understand our needs. So we should do it, and we can do it. We can do it. But we need the support and the help from our friends and colleagues and the NGOs outside Gaza, because there is a lot of need to do that. We might need, like, maybe consultations. Yes, we need it. We need equipment. Yes, we already mentioned that we need. But after we talk about all of that, we will back again to the point of political issue. We always face that problem in our working, that it is a political issue. It needs to be discussed between the politicians. But as engineers, I believe that Gaza should be a developed city. A very nice place, as Mr. Trump said, yes, it is a very nice place. We have the most beautiful weather in Middle East. I believe, yes, we have the most beautiful beach, true. But help us rebuild Gaza again, to be a good city, to be a nice city, a developed city, and help the people of Gaza to live in peace. So, I mean, when I think about Gaza, I need and I want, I dream about my kids to live in that city, in a peaceful environment, to have their options in this life. And again, when I think about this dream, I always see that there's politicians like Trump and others talk about their own plans. So to be realistic, you know, like, it is very difficult, but it can be done. It is not easy, but we can do it. We can manage and we can lead that process, but we need help. So people outside Gaza should understand that Gazans still need help, but they can lead their plans. They have all the human resources to do it. I will keep that a dream. I don't care what politicians think or plan for us, but this is my dream, my colleagues' dream, my family dream, everyone in Gaza dream about that. And one day, it will come true, inshallah.
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 Awesome. With people like you there, despite all the difficulties, I know that Gaza has a future, but we all have to do our part in terms of pressing our governments, keeping our voices raised, not letting anyone forget about Gaza. That's what Israel wants. They want us to forget about Gaza, to go back to the siege, to go back to slowly starving people, to force them out. We can't let that happen.
We're listening to Asim al-Nabi on Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Ali Abu Nima. Palestinian professor, poet, and dear friend Refat Al-Arir was murdered in Gaza by Israeli bombs on December 6, 2023. The whereabouts of his makeshift grave was unknown until recently. Asim led the search to find his remains and return them to his family.
Before you became an engineer and before you began your work with the Gaza municipality, you were a friend and a student of our beloved Professor Refat Al-Arir, who was murdered in the genocide on December 6, 2023, along with several relatives. This week, Asim, you performed an exceptionally difficult and important task in locating Refat's body and moving him to a permanent gravesite. Please tell us about that and what it means to you.
I knew Refat 25 years ago. When I was 9 or 10 years ago, my father sent me to a summer camp. I saw this beautiful guy there. He was like 19 years old or 20 years old. And he taught us how to sing like some Palestinian cultural songs. I can still remember that word till now. So then he has a very good connections with my family. My uncle, Dr. Hassan, was his teacher at the University of, at the Islamic University of Gaza. We have like a family relation, like his cousin got married with my sister. So also we are relative, like somehow. We did some projects together. So I can say that he was my friend, my colleague, my mentor, my supervisor, my teacher, my family friend. And even we had a special experience, like to live together in this genocide. We walked together, we talked, we ate together, we searched for water, we escaped from a place to place, we searched for internet, and he called it the long way for internet. So I want to start from your question. Two calls from his mother. 3 weeks ago, his mother, a very beautiful woman, respected lady, Omhani, we call it Khalto Omhani, Auntie Omhani. She called and she said, Asim, please, I want to feel comfortable. I want to find Rifat. I want to move him. And I know you were close to each other, so please let us do it. Then I said, this is like was like 2 days before the ceasefire. So I told her, yes, this is my goal now. Just let us do it. So it became my dream, became my goal and my daily routine in the last 2 weeks, like searching, finding. And I can't say it was easy. It was very difficult looking. And I don't think this is a popular experience. People didn't use to search for their friends in a makeshift graveyards. And just 2 hours ago, I received another call from his mother. She called me 2 days ago after we returned his body back to Ashujaiya, the neighborhood where he lived, where was he born and lived, and we met also in Ashujaiya for the first time. And she called me, she told me, now I can sleep well, Asim. After she lost 4 of her kids, like Rifat, Hamada, and Salah, and her daughter, Asma. So it's, and also 5 grandsons. So it's a big loss for her also. She called 2 hours ago and she said, Asim, I saw Rifat in my dream last night. And he was wearing a white dress, a very white dress, a very clean one. And she wanted to give him a watch. Then she told me after I saw him, he was wearing a very beautiful watch, even better and even nicer of my gifts. And she told me, I can't understand. What does that mean? So I told her, I don't know, but maybe this is like wearing a white dress means that he's in a good place. And maybe the watch that he is, it's like maybe he is staying eternally in a nice place. So I told her, sorry, I can't really explain the dreams, but this is what came to my mind exactly after you told me about that dream. So between the two calls, actually, we spent a very difficult moment. And if I want to talk about the details, it is very, very, very difficult. It's not easy. It's not easy to search in a makeshift graveyard looking for names. We are not talking about headstones with, you know, excellent handwritten or printed names. No. You are just searching in cartoons or papers, tape notes, and on literally on the sands. And a lot of them, it's already erased. A lot of makeshift graves are not really clear if this is a ground or if this is a grave, you know. I searched in 4 makeshift cemeteries. I read maybe more than 1,000 notes. Actually, I met numerous people, like potential people who may participated or saw something. But after a lot of searching, we found a guy who participated in that day. So we went to the place. He showed us where is exactly, believe that Rifat and his brother and his sister and another four nephews. And one of the things that shocked me that there was no exact number about how many person were with Rifat. Like even like his son said 8, his neighbor said 9, his brother-in-law said 7. So you know, like his relatives doesn't know exactly how many people with him because nobody participated. I mean, even his close friends, even his close family. I know that day it was like extensive and intensive targeting on Gaza, especially, you know, the month after the temporary ceasefire. It ends in the beginning of December, and then like we lost a lot of people on that month. And also the day of digging, I was literally afraid of that day. I brought the body bags, I brought the gloves, I brought the, like, you know, everything necessary. Then I searched for a specialist. I said, we need a specialist to help us digging for bodies, you know, human bodies. Then there is no one, because everyone said, like, there is a lot of cases like Rifat, thousands like Rifat. So everyone is taking care of his loved ones. So we went to the place. I informed his father, his mother, everyone, his friends, and we went to that place. We start to dig, and I can't tell you that my heart just stopped for a moment after we start to see the fabric, because on that time, they used to put people just in a covers, you know, a fabric covers, blankets. Then they just put them in the ground because no resources on that time. So when I saw the corner of that fabric, a part of that fabric, I like my heart just stopped for a moment. There is a lot of details. I'm not sure if the people would be able to listen to the details. Carrying your friend, like the bones of your friend, not your friend. Opening that blanket to check if to know him from his clothes. You know, like I'm shaking now. So after we did all of that, we carried him, we carried Rifat, we put him in our body plastic bag. We couldn't find the full body of Rifat, unfortunately. We found a full body for his brother Salah. Another brother knew him from his t-shirt. And he said, yeah, this is Salah's t-shirt. But we couldn't find Rifat. Body as Rifat. So we put 4 people in one body plastic bag. One of them was Rifat. And I had, since I am the last living person who met Rifat on that day, just 15 minutes before he was martyred. So people asked me, like, check, you may know from his t-shirt. And I had to look, I had to see. So I'm sorry that, I'm sorry to Rifat, I apologize to Rifat that I couldn't realize, I couldn't know. Sorry again for you to talk about these details, but Rifat was a professor. He is a respected man in Gaza, professor at the university, a genius man, researcher, writer, author. He deserved better than that. And everyone, actually, like everyone, every single man in Gaza deserves proper grief. Just proper grief. Like, and when I talked to my friends during the war, I was telling them, my dream is just, I want to be one piece. I want to die in one piece and to have my own grave. I don't want to be with others in, I don't want to share a grave with others. So this was our dream during the war. And I hope that no one in the world should live this experience, we moved him to Ash-Shuja'iyya, to Ibn Mirwan Cemetery. Seven people, we found seven people. Rifat al-Arayr, Salah al-Arayr, his brother, Ismail al-Arayr, his sister, and the other four nephews. We tried for 4 days to find the graves in Gaza. Like it's fully now the graveyards in Gaza. There is no space. So people, what they did in the few months, they used to open the old graves. Like if you have an auntie or uncle or father or mother, people used to open that grave and put the new bodies there because there is no space. We are talking about thousands of people. And I talked to many people that we need like graves, you know, this is like we just need graves. And we got only two graves for seven people. So they shared their suffering, they shared their death, and they shared their makeshift graveyard, and then they shared their eternal grave, two graves in Ash-Shuja'iyya. But at least we saw them, we built them, we cleaned that area, we did our cultural, you know. His father was like a great man. I used to hear about him, Rifat's father. Then, because, you know, in our religion, we do like a speech, a short speech after we put our loved one in the grave. So people ask me to do it. But then I said, no, I'm not going to do it. I can't say anything now. And they said, no, we know you are the spokesman. You can do it. Then I said, no, his father should do it. Then I went to his father in that moment. And I told him, Father, please. Do it. And he said, what can I say? And I said, no, just start and you will. And he said a perfect, you know, like a perfect speech about Rifat and his brother, his sister. You know, like I felt that, oh my God, that's what I needed in that moment. So Rifat came back to his neighborhood. I apologized for him because I feel like a bit comfortable about that. I shouldn't, you know, because there is thousands of people still under the rubble. There's thousands of people are still missing. So his story, Rifat's story is not a unique story. There's thousands of people still need to be moved. You need to find them first. You need to find them first. Then you need to move. You need to find another alternative place for them, a grave in Gaza. Then you need to dig, to find them, to find their bones, to find their remains. Then put them in a plastic body bag, which is very difficult to get it again. I went to the hospital and I said, I need 8 body bags. And I said, no, we can't give you only 4. And I said, what? I need 8 because we have 8 bodies. And they said, no, we can't. We have only limited amount of body bags. So I got only 4 instead of 8. So there is, like our suffering, there is a lot of deep details in that suffering. We can't just conclude it in starvation. There is a lot of details under that word. We can't just like genocide. I mean, I can't We are a simple people. Like I don't know. I am an engineer, a researcher. I am not a politician. I don't understand the political issues. But what I understand now from my academic background that no word can really explain what happened but genocide. Rifat's story, clearly it's a genocide. He was a great man. Till now, till the last moment, I was telling myself that no. He's still alive. He's joking. Because we know Rifat, he used to do this kind of comedian. But after we put him in that grave, I said, no, it's true that we lost him. Not me, not you. Everyone in this world lost Rifat. A very pure guy, a very simple soul, a genius man, a very smart human. Like, we are all losers because we lost Rifat. But again, he paid for his message. He tried his best to convey his message to the people, and he paid his soul, his blood, to show the truth to the people. So we have to choose whether we want to see it or just to neglect it and to say no, nothing happening in Gaza, and to propose a nice ideas like relocating the people there or whatever the politicians are saying right now on the world. May he rest in peace eternally. He deserved that. And I am planning for like a gathering for his students and his teachers and his colleagues soon after we prepare a nice headstone with his nice poetry, If I Must Die. We will engrave it on his grave. I'm trying to do that, inshallah, next week. Then we will talk about him, share our nice stories and jokes with him to make his dream true. That, like, because he told us what is his dream. Like, if I must die, you must live. To tell his story.
I think we're all speechless listening to you. What you told us is extraordinarily difficult to listen to, even. But what you did is an act of great love for your friend. I think it's the biggest act of love I can imagine. And for his family, for his mother, but for all the people, for his students, for his friends, and for all the people around the world who loved him, who got to know him, who got to know him even after he died, and who he continues to influence. And the point you make about this being the situation of thousands of families, thousands of people, every single one of them deserves dignity. And you gave that dignity to Rifat and his brother and sister and Rifat's nephews who were murdered together in that attack. And that's something extraordinary. And we're incredibly grateful to you for sharing that story with us. Awesome. We hope that you will come back again and talk to us about the situation in Gaza. And we're so grateful to you, Asim, for all the work you do, for the time you've spent with us. Thank you so much, Asim. God bless you, and God bless your work and your family and all your colleagues and everyone in Gaza.
Thank you so much, Asim.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
That was Asim Al-Nabi from Gaza City Municipality. Thank you for tuning in to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. Music by Greg Wilson.
What does existence mean to you? Collective Reflections, Queen's University's anti-oppression magazine, invites you to share your voice for Volume 12, Existence. From identity and resilience to celebrating cultural heritage, Collective Reflections welcomes poetry, short stories, essays, and visual art that showcase your unique perspective. Submissions are open now and due February 9, 2025. Let your creativity shine and be a part of this powerful collection. For questions